This is the HMO Success Podcast, episode 64, the Renters Reform Bill.
Welcome to the HMO Success Podcast. My name's Wendy, and this podcast will help you invest in houses of multiple occupation.
Today, I wanted to take a look at the Renters Reform Bill. In particular, what does it mean for HMOs? We've had quite a lot of talk in the media over the last few weeks about this particular bill. Well, that is before the leadership election took all our interest and engagement. That is if you're interested in politics. But my view is that if you are running a property business, politics comes into it. You can't avoid understanding some element of the law, of regulation, etc. So there is an element in which these are all political tools that enable successive governments to make their mark on the housing sector. So the Renters Reform Bill, perhaps I'll just give you a little bit of background and context, because there has been a change of direction in the last couple of years, particularly once Michael Gove became the Secretary of State for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, which is what the new housing department is called, Levelling Up Housing and Communities. So it encompasses the levelling up part as being quite critical to part of the government's agenda, as set out in their election manifesto in 2019. So the bill is part of the department's drive to level up, or whatever that means. I suppose it's about giving opportunities and economic infrastructure and investment to parts of the country that have been a little bit left behind. And I think we could clearly see that there is a north-south divide. I think if you look at house prices, if you look at economic achievement, if you look at output, you'll see that the north of the country does less well than the south. Now, that's not to say that we should downgrade the south. I do believe that London and the financial sector has contributed massively to the GDP of the UK overall, but nevertheless, perhaps underinvestment has gone into other parts of the north, such as the transport system, particularly that links some of those northern cities like Leeds and Sheffield and Manchester. So this is part of the government's overall strategy to look at how they level up. And they've decided to start by looking at housing. Now, in June 2022, a white paper was released, which you can go onto the government website and download, called A Fairer Private Rental Sector. And this is the white paper that leads the way for the Renters Reform Bill. That's the act that will become legislation. It's destined for becoming legislation in about 2024. So there's time for us to understand what will happen and how it will impact us. There are some big changes. There are some big changes with the Renters Reform Bill that we really have to grapple with and understand. And I suspect as the readings go through the House of Commons, unless you help your MP to understand what those implications are, it's likely that the rigour and critique of the bill, which is supposed to happen in the House of Commons, it won't happen. Because let's face it, housing law is very complicated, very complex. Somebody has described the bill as the biggest shake-up in the private rental sector in 30 years. And I would say that in many ways that is absolutely true. And since 1996, when we had the Landlord and Tenant Act, which introduced ASTs and Section 21, things have really remained fairly steady. In COVID, we obviously had a time when evictions were stayed, they were paused, you couldn't evict tenants, and the rules around that changed. But fairly quickly, I think the government realised that, the market had to go back to behaving the way it was behaving pre-COVID, and we've kind of returned to normal, although I believe there's still a very big backlog in the courts, actually. So the Renters Reform Bill sits within this context of this wider government department that wants to change things. I would call it shaking things up, not levelling up, because I'm not necessarily convinced that this is actually going to level anything up. I think it's actually going to make it more complicated. I think there are some knock-on effects which the government probably haven't considered, and I doubt that many of the civil servants who are drawing up these bills know much about HMOs. So they have made some they've made some proposals which are going to be very difficult to implement in an HMO. So let's just go through what the Renters Reform Bill is. Well, there are 9 key elements to the Renters Reform Bill, and I just want to run through some of the main ones to help you to see what this new act of government could mean. The first one is the abolition of Section 21. Now, it's really interesting, in this whole white paper that was produced in June, there's only one mention of HMOs, and it is a case study of an HMO in Blackpool that is not really up to housing standards. And they use this as a case of, you know, the importance of implementing the decent home standard. But apart from that, there is no mention of HMOs. And I do wonder whether the government have really considered the different forms of residential property, rented residential property that's on the market, and really understood how this might affect those tenants, might affect the landlords, might affect the local authorities. So the first one, the abolition of Section 21. And this is a real core proposal. You've probably heard about this already in the media. It's been discussed for the last couple of years, and in the Queen's speech last year, she mentioned this. And really what it means is that tenants will only be able to end a tenancy, and they'll have to give 8 weeks' notice to be able to end a tenancy. If a landlord wants to end a tenancy, they will have to use the Section 8. Now, of course, as we know, in a Section 8, you generally have to quote a ground for eviction, whereas a Section 21 is considered to be a no-fault eviction, which means that if you just don't like the tenant or there's another problem with the tenant, you can get rid of them. You do not have to go through the whole rigmarole of gathering evidence and it being a combative event. You can get rid of them sort of quietly, and there are ways in which, of course, they can also make their voice heard, but it's a fairly straightforward, I just want to repossess the property, thank you, and say goodbye. And I know many landlords use Section 21 even when there are rent arrears. They're happy to let the rent arrears go, even though that tenant may have incurred a lot of debt at the landlord's expense, but the tenant leaves, they may leave the property in a terrible condition, they might have messed up the property, but nevertheless what the landlord wants is a quiet life. Who doesn't? And so they get rid of that tenant with a Section 21. So the government is going to get rid of that ability to do that, and now you are going to have to be able to convince a judge, potentially, if it gets to court. But you'll also have to be able to demonstrate that there is a reason why you want to evict the tenant. Mostly, of course, it is due to rent arrears, but there are other reasons. And as we know, in an HMO where you have a group of people living together, sometimes it's somebody's behaviour that is very difficult or very antisocial. And you don't necessarily want to go down the route of a Section 8. You want to just be able to, help that person to leave. Okay, there's always the time delay, because with Section 21, of course, you've got to adhere to the time guidelines, which can take longer. But I think Section 21 is a very good tool, because it just allows you as a landlord to give notice to a tenant to regain possession of your property. And personally, I think if we are landowners and property owners, who has the right to take that away from us? That is our right. That was laid down in the Magna Carta. And as far as I'm concerned, it sticks. But the government are actually trying to remove that, and I think that is wrong, and I think there's going to be a backlash against this. I also think that tenants don't necessarily want to have to wait 8 weeks before leaving a property. So this is going to cause other upset when tenants realise they've got to give 8 weeks' notice before they have to leave. How many of them are just going to leave after a week or 2 weeks anyway? Now, at that stage, if you have got an empty room in an HMO, there are other considerations to think about. For example, if your property has been banded for council tax, that gap will mean that you now have to pick up the council tax. And there is no AST that will cover that, because the AST will by de facto be changed. And in fact, that is point 2 of the Renters Reform Bill, that they want to end fixed term tenancies. So let me go on to that in a moment, but I just want to kind of put a full stop on the Section 21. I think it is a retrograde step by the government. I think we're going to see a backlash both from tenants and also from landlords. And I suspect that there are going to have to be a number of additional caveats and methods that landlords will be allowed to use when they really want to get rid of a tenant but don't want to go down a Section 8. So number two is the end of fixed term tenancies. So this means that all tenancies will be periodic from their first day. So in other words, a tenant could move in, they don't have a 6 month period by which they are determined to stay in the property. They're periodic from the day that they move in, and they could give notice on the second day, and they'll give 2 months' notice and they'll move out. Let's say they don't particularly like the property or they've changed their mind. They can give 2 months' notice and move out. And there's nothing that you can do about that. So you could have a huge amount of churn in your HMOs as a result of this. Again, it doesn't give stability to the property market. And in my view, there is a question mark about how closely this aligns with serviced accommodation. For example, we had a serviced accommodation unit where we had a couple of contractors staying and they booked a 6 week stay. Now, this seems to run very, very close to the possibility of having an HMO where somebody might literally decide to stay for 8 weeks and on day two give their 8 week notice. However, you have been charging this as a residential unit. It isn't a serviced accommodation unit. So usually the charge is going to be slightly lower because you're depending on that tenant making it their main home, their main residence. So therefore rents are, if you compare rental amounts in the HMO sector and in the serviced accommodation sector, you'll see they're slightly higher in serviced accommodation. Well, that's to cover the costs of servicing the accommodation and also to cover the risk, because you might not be able to rent out that room or that property consistently over 52 weeks. Whereas in a rental accommodation, the aim is that you have it rented for 52 weeks of the year. And if you have somebody move out, you very quickly find another tenant to move in. You have longer term tenancies. Now, this, of course, will affect all HMO landlords, but it will also particularly affect the model for student landlords, where students historically have perhaps moved in September. They've either taken a 9 month or a 12 month AST. It's joint and several liability, so all the students will take one AST, and this allows certainty for them and it allows certainty for the landlord. And then come the end of the academic year, the students move out, the landlord might have to do some redecoration and probably a deep clean if the student HMOs I've seen are anything to go by. But following that, he or she can then re-let the property. And quite often, of course, these properties are reserved months in advance. They're reserved 6 to 9 months in advance. Well, that will end. You will no longer be able to issue a 6 month or a 9 month or a 12 month AST. There will just be a new form of agreement which will allow your students to give notice on day two and quit. Where is that going to leave you in terms of re-renting their room or that property if all those tenants decide to move out or change their accommodation or give up on their university studies? It gives much, much less certainty. Now, there is a student charity called Unipol, and they have said in reaction to this proposal that there's already a shortage of student digs and new purpose-built student accommodation is not coming online at anything like the expected rate. So there is already a shortage of student accommodation. And I think we've seen student numbers go up and up and up over the last few years. We're seeing more and more foreign students coming into the UK who don't have anywhere else to live. So the necessity for longer term and more permanent accommodation is absolutely vital. But this is a rug the government want to pull from under the feet of HMO landlords, especially if they are student landlords. Point number three, landlord grounds for possession. Now, the Renters Reform Bill pledges to give landlords more grounds for possession under Section 8 once they abolish Section 21. And apparently they're also going to improve the court process. At the moment, under Section 8, there are some grounds which are mandatory and some others which are not. So That means that judges would have to grant possession if you can prove the grounds, that mandatory grounds have been met. But again, the same emotional and practical issues would have to be faced simply by having to use Section 8, which, as we know, can cause upset and imbalance in the relationships in the house. If you're now having to gather evidence against a particular tenant, you're having to get views of the other tenants about this particular tenant, you know, it does not help harmonious relationships in the house. Rental arrears are covered under the Renters Reform Bill, and what they say is that landlords will be able to give notice to tenants with a history of rental arrears, even if they're not in arrears at that time. So you will be able to issue a Section 8 notice if somebody has previously been in two or more months of arrears on three or more occasions over a three-year period. And in this case, you'll only need to give the tenant 4 weeks' notice to leave your property. So that's good news that it will be foreshortened. Nevertheless, I can see this being a considerably more higher headache for landlords as they're starting to recognise there's going to be more paperwork involved. And the one thing we need is less paperwork, not more paperwork. The bill also states that antisocial behaviour grounds will be amended. So in the case of serious antisocial or criminal behaviour from a tenant, notice periods will be 2 weeks. Now under Section 8 at the moment, again, if you can evidence it and if you've got enough information, you can issue a Section 8 that actually is only a two-week period anyway. However, actually getting this to work in practice is often harder than it seems. Now, point number four is one which I think is particularly troublesome for HMOs. This is no more blanket bans on tenants with children or those receiving benefits. Ooh, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Of course, we would all love to be able to offer property to people who've got children, also pets, that's another point, that's a separate point, and those on benefits. But the fact is, as we know, in an HMO, if you're renting to the professional market, one of the key considerations that a tenant has is, who am I living with? Now, if you're now going to ban the ability to choose who your tenants are, in other words, if they've got a child or they're on benefits, they don't fit your profile, they're not working, how is that going to affect the makeup of the household? And this can have a seriously destabilizing effect on the other tenants when they realize that there's a new tenant who's moved in, who's on benefits, who's sitting around all day. Perhaps they're looking for a job. Perhaps they've got some other form of, you know, activity that they do during the day. But generally, it's going to make the other tenants feel cautious, feel perhaps a little bit nervous about somebody who's on benefits. And you can imagine why, because if they're working hard to try and make an income and make a better life for themselves, and they've got somebody in the house who's, you know, not doing that, you can imagine that there's going to be tensions that will arise. This is not about discrimination, but this is about practicalities. This is about pragmatic psychology that recognises that when you are all in the same boat, you're all of the same type, and you all have similar values, at least the values of working, paying your way, not stealing, not taking, not relying on somebody else for your income, which if you are on benefits, you are relying on somebody else for your income. I think this is going to destabilize the household. Now, there might be a case for saying if you have a tenant who's on benefits, you can put more tenants on benefits in a household. And I've seen that happen, and that can work pretty well. And I do think that, you know, there are some amazing people out there doing some great things for people who are unemployed, those who are on benefits who can't work, and those who are on benefits who are looking for work. And I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't support and help those people in some way. But if you're a professional HMO landlord, being able to have this ability to choose who stays in your property, who lives there, is vital to making that HMO run smoothly. Now, with regard to children, I think there are also some very big issues here. If you have a child that is going to be coming and living at that property because you can no longer say no, this, of course, has implications in terms of your license, because suddenly you've got another person living there. And there was a court case, the High Court ruled in 2018, that children under 18 are counted as residents for the purpose of calculating how many people live in an HMO, which means that you would have to go to the council and potentially increase the number of people who are listed on your HMO license. Will they do that? Will you have to pay another fee to do that? And how long is that child likely to live there with their parent? These are all really important questions that haven't been answered in the Renters Reform Bill. The other aspect, of course, is the room size. So if this child is now counted as part of the number of people in the HMO, you're going to have to think about the room size, because if that room size is not more than 10 metres squared, you can't have two people in it, 10 metres squared or above, you can't have two people living there. So let's say you've got an 8 metre square bedroom, you're not allowed to turn the person down, the adult who's got their child, but yet the room size is not big enough for them both to live in together. And of course, there's other questions, aren't there? How old is this child? What's the safety aspect? Is it right that a child, let's say a 5 or 6 year old, should be living in an HMO room with their parent, even if the license allows it and even if the room size is good enough? What about the other social implications? Do the other tenants want to be living with somebody who's got a child? Again, it just baffles me that the government have missed out the implications for HMOs in some of these crazy suggestions, because as a landlord, you know, we have to be able to make choices about who lives in our HMOs to make them run well. Next point is about pets. So this is another, I would say, very questionable suggestion, part of the pledge of the government. Yes, I understand that they want to make private renting more accessible to people. They're reacting to the tenants who've got pets or got children or are on benefits. The voice of Shelter and Generation Rent has been very loudly heard, and I get that. And I am not saying that those people shouldn't have some ability to have choice. In fact, I believe that choice, the free market, is what will allow them to find appropriate and suitable accommodation. However, you do not have to have a pet. If you have a pet, it is your choice to have a pet. And as a result of that, you have to consider what the implications are going to be. And does it mean that there's going to be landlords who don't want to rent to you? Possibly. And why should that right be conferred upon you because you have a dog or a cat? And then let's think about the implications for HMOs. So the Renters Reform Bill aims to make it easier for tenants to rent with pets, and that landlords would be unable to unreasonably withhold consent. That's the wording, that we won't be able to unreasonably withhold consent. Well, I'm not quite sure what that actually means, because when it comes to a test of unreasonableness or reasonableness in the law, that's very hard to determine. What one person says is reasonable is somebody else's unreasonableness. And in fact, the bill white paper lacks some detail on how this would work in practice. So I suspect when it comes to it, this clause may well be excluded. It may well be eliminated from the bill, because I just don't think it's workable. The other aspect of this is the Tenant Fees Act, because the suggestion would be that this would be adjusted so that pet insurance becomes an allowable and chargeable fee. Now, that is good news, and it means that your insurance will now be able to cover any damage that the pet might incur, and you can charge that to the tenant. Of course, at the moment, many insurance companies don't offer that, so there's going to be a bit of a shake-up there too. So there's quite a few kind of ramifications from the Renters Reform Bill. Number 6 is the Decent Home Standard. So the Decent Home Standard was actually initiated for council houses a number of years ago. And I think it was about 2006. And it was written to address housing standards in the public sector. housing associations and social housing associations. And I just think it is really rich that the government now wants to turn their attention to the private rental sector, where actually standards have historically been a lot higher than in social housing. Let's not forget that. And now they're turning onto the PRS and basically getting us to spend our money on our properties. Again, I'm not wanting to suggest that, you know, we should offer houses that are in a terrible condition to people that have got damp and mould and, you know, are unfit for human habitation. No, not at all. I think some standards need to be maintained. But I think we can go too far. And I think with the regulation that is potentially coming over the horizon for landlords in the next 2 to 3 years, the government has to be very careful that it doesn't disincentivize people to invest. And if this means a huge amount of additional cost to the landlord in terms of double glazing, heating, heat pumps, EPCs, etc., etc., while we may think this is good for the environment, we also know that sometimes these have this legislation has alternative impacts. Let me give you an example. The other day I was listening on the radio, a conversation about the impacts of the Grenfell fire and how cladding was deemed to be responsible for that, the particular type of cladding that was used, and that this spread the fire, you know, fantastically through the building. And since then, there's been a review of building regulations. As a result of that review, the impact has been that now we're building fewer and fewer houses out of wood. Now you might say, well, why does that matter? Well, wood is a very sustainable product when it comes to construction. And in fact, it's a very good, strong material to use for construction. But because of the change in building regulations, wood is now a very minimal source of construction material. Steel, concrete, bricks, these are all favoured now by the construction industry. We know that trees don't cost an awful lot to grow. They take time, but they don't cost a lot of money to grow. And you can quite easily grow trees for construction. And of course, historically, that's what mankind has done for thousands of years. But because of these new regulations about fire and health and safety, we've gone to completely the other way. The pendulum has swung in the opposite direction, and now we're not using wood, which is a very, very good, sustainable and ecological material for construction. So we've got to be very careful that when we make these broad brushstrokes, when we change the law, when we say we're going to implement this that's going to help these people, or we're going to start this that's going to do this for these people, what are the other costs? What are the other implications? And I see this very strongly, the Renters Reform Bill, is that we're going to see other problems emerge that the government may not be able to spot at the moment, but it will happen. One of the, if I was Housing Minister, one of the suggestions that I would have, and I think this is very important when you're thinking about new rules, new legislation, is to have a trial. Why do they not pilot this in a small area of the country? Why don't they pay landlords and say, we want to implement a trial of the Renters Reform Bill in this area? You will now be trialing it. You could maybe opt in. You could say, right, for, you know, maybe £100, or I don't know what it'd be, £1,000 or something, you will be our trial group, and we would like you to trial this as if it were law. Come up with what the problems are, come up with the challenges, just as you would if you were running a private business or a company where maybe you had developed a new idea or a new policy or a new product. Before going out to the full market, you might get a group of testers. You'd have a market research group, you'd have a focus group, you might have a group of customers or clients who you might say, listen, I just want to try this out, see if it works, you come back with feedback and then we'll adjust it. But it seems that the government does not do this, much to their discredit, because they would learn so much in piloting it. Anyway, that's what I would do. Under the Decent Home Standard, there will be some additional requirements, some of which have already started to be rolled out. smoke and CO2 detectors, electrical installation condition reports being required for all private rental homes, minimum energy efficiency standards in private rental homes, and Homes Fitness for Human Habitation Act 2018 will have to be followed. Local councils will also be given greater powers to enforce the Decent Homes Standard and deal with landlords who don't comply. So it might be that we see changes to HMO licence conditions as a result of that particular element of the bill. Number seven is the landlord portal and ombudsman. Well, I was a non-executive director in the NHS when the government were rolling out the national programme for IT. Ah, yes. What a white elephant that was. I wonder how much money the government wasted in doing that particular programme, which never happened. That was a national programme to effectively take people's private records, their health records, which were, for most people, in the most part, paper. Remember the old days when you'd go and see your GP and he'd get your file out. Normally it was a he, but it could have been a she. And she would make notes on your paper file. And this would go into your, you know, a buff coloured envelope that would sit somewhere in the back of the GP's office. Yes. Now, we've moved on since then. Generally now, your health records are held on a computer system, but they're still very disparate because GP surgeries work almost like small businesses these days, and there's no linkage to all that data. It's been improving over the last 10 years, but when I was a non-executive director, there was still a lot of paperwork being used. So the government decided to roll out a national program for IT, and it fell horrendously flat on its face. Because generally, government are very poor at rolling out IT systems. They become behemoths. They become huge, unworkable machines that people don't understand and often have huge amounts of glitches in them because they are rolled out too quickly, on too big a scale, at too fast a rate. So while this idea about a landlord portal may sound like a fantastic, you know, blue sky thinking, you can just imagine, can't you? Michael Gove walks in one day. Okay, guys, what I'd like us to do, actually that's not a very good accent, is it? He's more Edinburgh. What I'd like us to do today is to see if we can figure out a way of getting some great ideas out in the Landlords Reform Bill to give people a fantastic solution to their problems, particularly tenants. Why don't we have a portal where all landlords can put their information in and we can keep track of them, those naughty buggers who want to charge rent for their rooms. Oh, something like that. Now, what's being suggested in the bill is that a private renters ombudsman would be created, so all landlords would have to sign up to this. And this is something which currently, of course, applies to rental agencies, letting agencies and estate agencies already. But now, as a private landlord, you would also have to sign up to be sort of managed or overseen by the ombudsman. And secondly, you will have to sign up to a portal. So all of your information, details about your property, etc., would have to be uploaded to the portal. I just think it's a dreadful idea. I don't think it's going to work. And I suspect that within 6 months of them starting it, they'll recognise it's far too big a task. And if at the moment local councils can't even identify who the landlords are in their area, and why should they be able to? We are private rental businesses. We run our business. We shouldn't need to have an overarching eye from the state telling us what to do and how to do it. Nevertheless, I think that the portal will not work. Simply put, it will be a complete waste of time. Again, it will be typically the good landlords, those who take their responsibility seriously, who will utilise it. They will also sign up for the ombudsman, and all the people who you really want to be on there will not be on there. So it will be a waste of time and probably a big waste of money. Okay, number eight, rent reviews and notice periods. So rent reviews will be limited to one per year, and the revised notice period of 2 months, in line with the abolition of Section 21 and the imposition of only periodic tenancies, would mean that you could only give a notice period of 2 months for any increase in rent. Now, of course, How does this affect your HMO rooms? Does this mean that you can only increase rent in an HMO room over a year? What if you have three or four tenants over that year? I'm presuming you would be able to increase rent in between the tenancy. So when the tenancy changes over. Again, this is not covered in the notes of the Renters Reform Bill. The White Paper does state, this government does not support the introduction of rent controls to set the level of rents at the outset of a tenancy. Historical evidence suggests that this would discourage investment in the sector and would lead to declining property standards as a result, which would not help landlords or tenants. Well, great. We have one sentence in this whole bill that seems to think about the needs of the landlord, that recognises that landlords should be able to set the levels of their rent. Good. Long may that continue. One of the flexibilities that we have as landlords is that the rent is not set. Now, this is good news for tenants because it means if a tenant comes to me and wants to negotiate the rent, and I occasionally will have a tenant who will say, could you accept this level of rent instead of that level of rent? We can do a bit of a deal. And this is how private business works, isn't it? That we've kind of got used to this idea that prices are set, but actually we can negotiate. A few months ago when we were flying out to Barbados for our family holiday, I was sort of mulling around the airport, as you do before you get on the flight. And I walked into the Ted Baker shop and I saw a very nice dress there. And I thought, oh yeah, I really like that dress. And it was on the sale rail already. And one of the things that I really love to do is get discounts on sale items. Mrs. Frugal, that's what you can call me. And as I was looking at this dress, I tried it on and it fitted. And I thought, yeah, I really would love to buy this dress for the holiday. I noticed that a button was missing on the back of the dress, where it did up around the neck. So I thought, I'll use this as a negotiation point. So I took the dress to the till and I said to the lady, I realise it's already discounted because it's in the sale, but the button is missing from the back. And she said, oh, there's a spare one in the hem. You can use that. I said, I know, but I'm going to have to sew it. And I'm going on holiday and I haven't got a sewing kit with me. You know, I'd really like to be able to buy this dress. And who else is going to buy the dress when they also realise the button is missing? And actually, you're selling something that isn't really standard. You've got other dresses of exactly the same style that have got a button, and this one doesn't. So, you know, it would be great if you could give me a discount. And she gave me a discount. It was only about £15, but nevertheless, that was great. So we kind of need to kind of get back into that idea that actually with rental property you can negotiate. In fact, I had a tenant the other day who contacted me about a flat that we had up for rent, and she wanted to move into the flat, but her viewing was going to be later than the first people who were going to view. Anyway, the first people viewed and they decided to take the flat at the rent that was advertised. Then I messaged this lady saying, very sorry, the flat has gone, and I'll have to cancel the viewing. She then wrote back saying, oh, I'm so disappointed. I was really looking forward to seeing this flat, was a bit unhappy about it. But I thought to myself, okay, you can make me an offer. No, nothing signed, sealed and delivered with this other family. If we get into a bidding war, I know it's unpleasant, but this is how the world works. If you have limited resources, limited supply, you have to pay more money for them. That is supply and demand. If there's only five cars on the planet and you want one of them, you are going to be paying a lot of money for that car. That is how life works. But we've kind of gone away from that and we feel that the prices should be set by other people. And I think we need to rediscover that art of negotiation and making an offer. That's how you buy a house, isn't it? The house is a guide price, effectively. And very often what we want to do is get that price down. The same goes for rent. She could have made me a better offer, but she didn't do it. So I'm glad that the government has realised that this has benefits for tenants and landlords not having rent controls. Rent controls are a very, very bad idea. And then point 9, tenant modifications.
This is another area where I think that the government hasn't really properly thought it through, again, with regard to HMOs. However, I think we're going to be waiting to see whether there is actually some guidance on this, because to me, this really does speak to those tenants who maybe stayed in a property for 2 or 3 years and they're complaining that the landlord won't let them do any redecoration. I think there will be more guidance on that particular factor, and let's hope that there is some guidance with regard to HMOs, because the last thing you want is to find out that your tenant has redecorated your beautiful room in black with a bright fuchsia pink feature wall. Ooh, interesting. So that's a bit of a sum up of the proposed renters reform bill. Unfortunately, the time for submitting your comments has actually now passed, so you can't do that anymore, but you can send comments to your MP if you feel so motivated to do so. And I do believe that actually as landlords, we need to keep making our voice heard to the powers that be. So please do make your voice heard. Keep going with what you're doing. If you're investing in HMOs, you're doing a grand job. You're providing incredibly valuable accommodation for the UK population. It's a brilliant thing that you're doing. Keep doing it. There's more demand than ever. Rents are going up, but also demand is going up. And we know that in the energy crisis, people are looking for something which is certain. They like the certainty of an all-inclusive rent. So if that's the model you're offering, I'd love to hear from you. I'm also looking for people who might be willing to come onto the podcast and be interviewed. So if either you're an HMO investor, landlord, or you provide services into this industry, please get in touch and I'll have you on the podcast. In the meantime, have a great week. I look forward to speaking to you next week, where I have a very special guest lined up, and have a fantastic week. Until then, bye. Thank you for listening to the HMO Success Podcast. If you'd like to know more about how you can create a profitable HMO business, please visit our website, hmosuccess.co.uk, to find out more. We have plenty of free tools and information for you there, and also on our Facebook group, The Ultimate HMO Success System. We look forward to connecting with you very soon. Thanks for listening.